Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is part 2 of episode 56, where we are discussing the work of Charles Clinton Spalding, particularly his 1927 article, Administration of Big Business, published across two editions of the newspaper Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the discussion. So in the first part, we kind of explored the main ideas from Charles Spalding, and specifically in his text, The Administration of Big Businesses. And we talked about how he wrote the text in order to help the community of Black businesses in coming to grips and being able to run successfully operations, and how in that text and his overall work also, it has a number of important principles and ideas and almost like a specific type of style of management and leadership. And we unpacked a bit of the causes of that and the its specific configurations. And in this part, we are going to look more into how his ideas are still very relevant and can inform not only management theory and practices, and the overall repercussions, so to speak, that exist. So one specific idea that I had as I was reading both the work of Spalding and the work of Leon and Simone on that, is that nowadays in management theory and practice, there is some emergent discussions on how specific religious beliefs or systems influence business and management practices. There is considerable research being done about Islamic finance and how Islam in general influences both the nature of the organizations, but also the type of leadership that exists. And it's interesting to read Spalding and notice that we can already see a case in which religion, in this case Christianity, seems to be central to the exact ways in which the corporation was run and the overall ideas he's had in terms of, you know, leadership and management.
Yes. So in his management of the mutual, the Christian faith played an integral role. However, in contemporary times, there is this concept of workplace spirituality, and how he ran this his business and the culture of his business is reflective of him having workplace spirituality in that culture as well. Now, today, workplace spirituality has nothing to do with a specific religion or religious practice. It's really about finding meaning in your work and your work having purpose. So it's just like that idea of a religion giving your life purpose and making you feel like you have a place in this world to make a difference, that when you go to work, some people's work fills that void and it's like a religion to them. So workplace spirituality is about doing work that is meaningful and that has a purpose and that makes people feel good. And so his work did do that. It gave people purpose, people in the Black community that he employed, it gave them purpose as well. And nowadays, that idea of workplace spirituality is, it has some criticism as well. So some people believe in that concept of workplace spirituality. So it has its fans and it has its critics. You know, some people think that it's just a fad and it's a term that could really mean just treating your employees well at work. This idea of workplace spirituality. But some people also think that it actually is significant and that it has a place in today's organizations. But his C.C. Spalding's, the culture that he nurtured, apart from the Christian faith, it does have this element of what we would call today workplace spirituality.
Okay. So I think there are many faces to what we are talking about. The first one, I think it has to do with the connection between religion and businesses. And what I, if I understand correctly, what you're saying, that's beyond that, there's also something that was specific and local that was constructed by Spalding, and which is what you are calling workplace spirituality. And in a way, it still lives on if you think about the concern about meaningfulness at work. And there are many contemporary discussions about that. You know, it has always existed, but it's still a very strong stream of questions and ideas and work being done on that.
And well, the term workplace spirituality, it wasn't constructed by Spalding. That's quite a new term. You know, it's a contemporary term. But the way he ran his business, when you look back and you consider what this new term means, you can see that back then, his culture reflected workplace spirituality. So it's not a term that he constructed, you know, but it's back then, the culture that permeated the mutual, it reflected workplace spirituality.
I'm just thinking, well, this term is a bit new to me, but the other thing that I was reflecting upon that is that, is this connected? I mean, so let's put it this way. How secular is this idea of workplace spirituality? Because as you're describing in terms of, you know, having meaning and purpose, in a way, it seems almost to be a bit detached, I think, from religion itself. We could maybe associate that with things like mindfulness and generous discussions that are entering the workplace now, which in a way always, you know, some of that existed before, but maybe it's just like it has new terms and arrives in a different way. So is this spirituality we're talking about one that is based upon religion, or is the one that's more about the meaning of work?
It is definitely not based on religion. So as you said, you're correct, it is detached from religion and any specific religion. But the reason they call it workplace spirituality is, you know, people look to religion a lot of times to find a higher purpose for their lives. And so this idea, if you bring that into the workplace, is that idea of work filling that void that people usually search for in religion, that purpose that they're looking for. And so they find it in their work. So that is the idea of workplace spirituality. Work fills that place of that higher calling, per se, that they're looking for. Yes.
It seems to me that Spalding viewed his profession as more than just a job. It was almost that he saw he had a higher calling. And I think we can maybe see that just from how long he stayed in the job. I mean, he could have retired, and, you know, nowadays we talk about enjoying your retirement. That didn't seem to be something that he was interested in, because he had this calling to serve the community and serve his employees by being an excellent administrator.
Yes, I definitely agree that he saw his job as it being part of his calling. And in the article, it also mentioned that, you know, when he preparing for work and especially meetings, board meetings, etc., he asks himself, is he fit to be an executive? So a lot of times it is not just him seeing him. He saw himself not just as a person doing a job and helping people, but he wanted to be a true representative of God based on his Christian faith as well, where that idea of being fit to carry out this higher purpose that he saw as being reflective as, you know, that calling from God as well. So it was his faith and his spirituality did play an integral part in his life and in his work and how he conducted business.
But his work was definitely a spiritual mission. And even a journalist who was interviewing him, I think the journalist came from the Saturday Evening Post, and he even made an observation that Spalding's work seemed to be like a spiritual mission that he was undertaking. So he definitely saw this than just him just managing an insurance company. It was much bigger than that. And it also went further in the aspect of him pretty much showing the world that people of African descent were able to take on such a large undertaking of managing such a successful business. So he almost placed himself under a lot of pressure in the sense of he was trying his best to prove
article
to the
as
world
well
that
when he talked about asking himself if he's fit. He also went on to say that he's reminded that he is an instrument of God. So he literally spoke about feeling like he was God's instrument. And as such, it was his duty and his responsibility to do his job the best way possible to help people, because that would have been what God would have wanted him to do.
So I'm listening to that, and it's always difficult to understand why an author is not, you know, taken up by the canon. And of course, one obvious reason is that Spalding was an African-American. But I wonder if there is something deeper than that. And before I mention, you know, how management theory in general has kind of sidetracked management leaders that reflect on their practices because it became a more of an academic endeavor. But it seems to me that this specific view of management and leadership in terms of being, you know, something that's bound by a calling, that is something that has a higher purpose, that is something that has a higher goal, and also a specific agenda in terms of, as you were saying rightfully, of showing the capacity of African-American people and businesses to thrive, whether that has coded it in ways that prevented it from being taken by the canon. Because I think that now, as Simone mentioned, in a workplace spirituality, there seems to be discussions that are very aligned with what Spalding was talking about. But I think for a long time, standard management theory and practice, for better or for, you know, worse, kind of wiped out these kind of concerns. Certainly concerns about the community, as we said before, but also a view of management that is more than just a technical job, so to speak. You know, so I wonder whether his ideas were particularly dormant because it clashed with specific ideas we had of what it is management.
Interesting. I mean, it's a possibility, but I do believe the main reason that Spalding's work wasn't really included in the canon, it was due to segregation and Jim Crow. I think that's the major reason, because African Americans were pretty much disenfranchised, and you know, their thoughts and some of their contributions, many of their contributions were pretty much ignored, unless it was contributions in sports or something like that. But in terms of intellectual history and intellectual contributions, those things were pretty much ignored. And I think it's quite unfortunate, because the work of Spalding is applicable to people of all walks of life, you know, and I hope people really do consider it as something that could actually add value to the way they manage their business, because it is some useful advice.
Yes. So as I was reading, especially your work with Simone on Spalding, I see that there were some mentionings that he met W.E.B. Du Bois, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Du Bois, the African-American sociologist. And, you know, interestingly, right now in, let's say, mainstream sociology and social sciences in general, as I understand it, W.E.B. Du Bois is having, an aurora. It's like it's becoming finally, in a way, part of the canon. Is, you know, there are books being written, there is a bigger awareness about this very important work that was very systematic and not pushed aside. So I was thinking about this interesting parallel that seems to exist in Spalding in management and W.B. Du Bois in social sciences and sociology more specifically.
Yes, W.E.B. Du Bois, well, that's how he pronounced his name. Of course, the French pronunciation is Dubois, but he went by W.E.B. Du Bois. He's another figure in academia that has been somewhat overshadowed based on his race, but he even had his own interesting philosophy of economic cooperation. So W.E.B. Du Bois wrote extensively about black businesses. He even wrote a report called The Negro in Business in 1899, where, it was a study he conducted while he worked at Atlanta University. And he compiled a list of the African-American businesses that existed, because he was a sociologist and he was looking for ways to help reduce crime and all these things in different communities. And Booker T. Washington, who was another prominent leading African-American, got a hold of W.E.B. Du Bois's research, and he formed a company called the National Negro Business League. So W.E.B. Du Bois, he played a very significant role in black enterprise and in the formation of this organization that was spearheaded by Booker T. Washington, who was also a very influential figure in Spalding's life. And Spalding also had a great respect for W.E.B. Du Bois. And when Du Bois visited Durham, North Carolina, where the North Carolina Mutual was headquartered, he was very impressed with the work of Spalding and so forth, right? So Spalding really respected W.E.B. Du Bois. But in his own regard, Du Bois was a pioneer when it comes to black businesses. And he also promoted this whole tradition of black economic cooperation. As I mentioned earlier, this whole philosophy of cooperation, which stemmed from Africa, and Du Bois even theorized that this whole cooperative ethic, which permeates the African community in the United States, came from Africa.
In the podcast, I'm usually known as the devil's advocate, or the one that tries to show the other perspective. So I want to try something here. This whole discussion of the specific philosophy of cooperation, and we talked about in the previous part, you mentioned Leon Simon about Ubuntu and everything, and how this specific philosophy, you know, survives and seems to have informed African American leaders and businesses. It's all very interesting, but I wonder, in today's day and age, in which segregation, of course, arguably there is still, of course, racism and inequality, and that's very much visible, but segregation has a different face or shape. And, well, at least I might be wrong, but I think it's a bit harder to try to differentiate specifically, you know, a corporation that is entirely African-American in character or in staffing or in leadership. You know, there is a bit more of mix, so to speak. So I was a bit wondering the extent in which such philosophy or such principles or such ideas, you know, they might live in specific pockets geographically, in specific types of businesses, or, you know, how can we still speak of an African-American type of management or idea in a world in which segregation is certainly different?
Well, you mentioned segregation being different from racism, but I would want to say that it is my opinion that segregation was actually because of racism. So there would not have been segregation if there wasn't that racism present. But yes, I would say that the traditions, these African traditions we mentioned, yes, they were starting to be lost, but they weren't totally gone. So there were a lot of people that weren't aware of it or didn't know that this tradition or what they were accustomed to in terms of helping people and cooperation stemmed from their past and from their history. They didn't know that. But, you know, sometimes when you are part of family, etc., things end up living on, but you just don't realize how or why they stay there. You just know that this is part of who you are, or this is how you've done things. And so this idea of Ubuntu, a lot of African Americans would not have known after all those years that what they were practicing came from Ubuntu, or even have heard it before, but it was still a part of them. It was lying dormant, maybe, but then it ended up resurfacing. And so it was, you know, as if that part of them that was dormant, it was dormant, but yet it was not dead.
And an example of this is growing up in Trinidad, you know, I used to take part in a tradition known as SUSU, which is a tradition of cooperative economics that stemmed from Africa. It's like a rotating savings association. And I had no idea that came from Africa until, you know, I spoke to some friends from Nigeria and Ghana, and they said, oh, yeah, we practice SUSU. And SUSU is still practiced in Trinidad, it's called
different
in Jamaica,
names,
and Guyana,
under different names in different countries.
It lost its
but the
Africanness,
same,
if I could create
the same
a
thing.
Word. But it remained, it survived.
I just want to say one thing for the record. I totally agree that racism is the cause for segregation.
Oh, okay.
I think I was not clear what I was trying to. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. My point was that, you know, racism is still thriving, unfortunately, but segregation as it was in the past is just different. That was trying to say. This story is very interesting, and there is actually research in management that has shown a similar dynamic in organizations. I'm thinking specifically about the work of Tamar Zilber, and she has this very interesting paper about, I think it's an organization that supports women that have been, you know, suffered violence. And I think this was her PhD about, that what she studied. And what she noted there is that there were a set of principles that came from feminism in terms of the way the meetings were run, the ways they understood the causes of violence, the ways, you know, they thought it was important to treat the victims and the kind of support was important to provide them with. That was at the first, you know, in the creation of the organization was very associated with a number of feminist principles, and that kind of informed the practice and routines of the center. And then time passed on and the staffing changed, and, you know, new people came arrive because it was dependent on volunteers. So new volunteers arrived, and the people that end up working there were mostly, I think, psychologists. So they continue to do the same practice, but they just saw them under the lenses of psychology. But the thing was the same. They just attached an understanding that was different. So your story is, of course, is a broader one, but it's interesting to see that we can make the hypothesis that in certain organizations, maybe specific places, you know, some of these principles might have informed some routines and practices that can still live on, but they're just thought as caused by different things or having a different kind of, you know, origins.
C.C. Spaulding was actually an advocate of diversity and bringing people together. So it wasn't just cooperation and teamwork among the Black community, but he also expanded it to be inclusive of the white community. So he did hire white employees as well. And so that idea of him recognizing that the world will be a better place if it's more inclusive and if everybody understands the importance of unity and cohesiveness and coming together for the better good of everyone could make a business more successful and make even life better in the community.
If only there were more Spauldings.
Very true.
Yes, so we've spoken a lot about Spaulding's emphasis on cooperation and teamwork, and not as much about the other important necessities that he identifies. So maybe we can talk a little bit about some of those. So he places a lot of emphasis on having managerial responsibility and clear lines of authority. As to quote from him, he says, there must always be some responsible executive who must pass upon every issue that is fundamental. He must be the final authority from whom there is no appeal except to the entire group in conference. Nowadays, we're seeing trends in other directions away from this sort of necessity, you know, and I'm thinking specifically about decentralized business structures, decentralized decision making, even some businesses claiming that they don't have a boss or a manager. Everyone is their own manager. And we have the emergence of things like agile teams. So I guess the question is, to what degree is that sort of emphasis applicable in current work environments?
Okay. In the current work environment, I would say that, well, let me start with what you mentioned about what he said about the authority and responsibility, and there needs to be that responsible executive. He recognized that there needs to be someone in power or authority, but you need to not abuse your power. And also that idea of responsibility, he understood the importance of being ethical. And so that is important as well today. And also, as you mentioned, today with decentralization and giving other people a voice, that idea of participative management, as we call it now, is really important, because you realize that if you give other people a chance to give their opinions, you make sure that they have a voice and you listen to them, especially when they have a certain amount of expertise and they can contribute. If you recognize that and you allow them to contribute, then your job as the responsible executive becomes easier, because you can learn from them if you just give them a chance. But also, they're more likely to follow you because you have not just what we call legitimate power because of your title, but you also have like a personal source of power. You have the expert power because of your expertise, but you also have referent power, because then they'll admire you and they will really recognize that they like you because you're the person that doesn't take advantage of the power and that you give them a chance to shine as well. So in contemporary times, I think that it's that idea of decentralization and empowering other people as a leader, not just wanting to be the one in charge, is really important.
And if I may add to that, and that's one of my personal grudges, because I'm interested in form organization and especially bureaucratic organizing, which sometimes gets a bad rap and people don't realize how much of that still is relevant for today. And how much of that still exists in some of this kind of, you know, so-called new forms of organizing. Anyway, my point is that participative management and even things like, you know, agile require a very well-structured structure, you know, a very well-plotted and organized design. And, you know, the case of participative management is exemplary. In some ways, there is this idea that to create a participative atmosphere is to remove structure, but actually research shows it's the opposite. If you do not have, you know, formal structure that makes sure that people have the space in the meetings, the specific roles that they can play, they have, you know, it becomes harder, for example, to speak up. Of course, it can always go in multiple ways, but structure can actually be enabling and fundamental to allow for empowerment and decentralization. And in a way, things like, you know, self-management teams or agile operations, they very much require authority structured and a set of relations and roles that can make possible such decentralization. Is this the only point is that is a structure that, you know, is put in place to allow for autonomy. But you need to have that designed and structured in the first place.
Yes. Especially back then, during that context, structure was definitely needed with North Carolina.
But you know,
it was very important for him to effectively manage that business.
And yeah, I wanted to agree with you because in the absence of structure, you'll end up with chaos. So you do need some kind of guideline, even when you're empowering people and you're letting people have a voice, to make sure that you know, you even get things done, because sometimes you just keep going. People might have their ideas, but without structure, you may not be focused or have direction and what you need to get things done. And so when you're talking about group work, especially and empowering people, you mentioned roles, but with group work, in addition to even people knowing what role or what part they have to play, you also have to have some agreement in terms of the norms that are going to be associated with this group, the expectations. So how people are expected to behave, what are the expectations in terms of what people need to do, etc. So you're right in terms of the structure being important. So even structure sometimes gets a bad rap because people associate structure with bureaucracy and people don't like that term bureaucracy, yes. But it is important. I guess you need to have the right balance between, you know, bureaucracy and empowerment.
Yes, certainly. Yes. Yes. Well, the medicine and the poison is just the dose.
Correct.
The difference.
No, just Pedro, that you are so predictable in taking the bait as soon as there's a hint of a discussion around bureaucracy.
I know, but you know, it's my purpose. That's one of my goals in academia, is to take away the bad rep of bureaucracy and you know push for a more, you know, complex understanding of whatever it is. But I wanted to push our conversation to a different theme, reflecting on what we said in the first part on the importance of African-American businesses and leaders in their commitment towards the community. And the very company that Spalding worked, insurance company, from what I understand, it was central because African-Americans were blocked away from the norm insurance companies. This, in a way, reveals the link between, the work of Spalding and African-Americans in general with entrepreneurship. And as we said and discussed, of a specific kind of entrepreneurship, one that is social, you know, that's one in which is committed not just for profit, but, you know, giving back to the community. And I think this is very interesting because if you think about it, it's almost that businesses are handling problems that are societal, and we could expect the government to be the one ultimately responsible to handle and to do. I mean, of course, in the case of the post-depression North America, the government was interested in keeping African Americans from getting the services. You know, there was the whole segregation, racism, and everything. But what I wanted to highlight is that still today, I think there is this kind of dynamics happening. I have a colleague here at Emilion that she has studied the banlieue, the quartiers in Paris that are, you know, have a higher percentage of poor and immigrant populations, and how the government here has for some time now tried to promote entrepreneurship as a possible way to, you know, provide more jobs, provide more wealth, and provide more security, and so on and so forth. So in a way, almost like pushing aside. And it's kind of surprising because in a place like France, the state has a very strong role in providing social security to citizens. But even here, there is this kind of, you know, use of the idea of entrepreneurship as perhaps a substitute for where the state has been failing. And I see similar things in Brazil as well, in the way entrepreneurship has been both push sometimes or pulled from the communities themselves as a way of, you know, there's the only way to handle the problems. Unfortunately, the state has failed, so it's up to us. So it was just like my observation.
That's a very good point. A lot of times entrepreneurs are born out of need or necessity. So they start a business because they see a need, not just in the community, but their own need for a job. And so, for example, in countries in Africa, for example, Nigeria, etc., there are a lot of students that they're very well educated. They have their university degrees. They graduate, but there are no jobs available. And so they turn to entrepreneurship and they start their own businesses. And so a lot of times that is how entrepreneurial ventures are born. And so that need-based kind of entrepreneurship, there's also overlap between that and social entrepreneurship, because you see a need for yourself for a job, then you create an entrepreneurial venture, and then you need employees. And so you hire other people who are also unemployed. And so it goes like that. So a lot of times entrepreneurship is not just about doing something you're passionate about, but it's about recognizing a need in society and filling that need in the market.
My only concern is that, of course, this is all great and important, is that I feel that it can get on, it takes away the responsibility of the state sometimes to providing or handling kinds of, you know, social issues. And I'm thinking specifically of the work of my colleague, Nevena Radenovska, here at Lyon, and the Quartiers in France, in which I think, some of her findings is that it's a de-responsabilization, so to speak. You know, it's the use of the idea of entrepreneurship, which it can be empowering and is important, but it's a way to say, well, we just won't, you know, bother anymore.
You're right. So, it's a very complicated issue, I think, because mm-hmm. governments do have a role to play. And so they shouldn't shirk their responsibility when it comes to that. But also, you can see that the populace can also play a role. So it's very complicated. It's hard for me to take a stance on, you know, one side or the other.
And some people may argue that the government do too much. You know, so it's up to entrepreneurs to fill that need, you know, and to stop relying on the government as well. So it does depend on the context.
Yeah, indeed. We are almost towards the end. So I was wondering if you, Simone Lyon, has any kind of theme or thing that we missed that you'd like to talk about and discuss?
I think we covered everything. We talked about culture. We tied it in the history of Spalding and the mutual to culture and contemporary concepts and leadership, you know, learning, diversity. And we also mentioned, you know, the book, which gives more information on not just Spalding, but other African-American managers and leaders as well in other industries, you know, in banking, in the beauty industry, etc.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we pretty much covered some of the major points, but, you know, if the viewers or the listeners get the book, you know, they will see a whole array of African-American business pioneers who contributed to this field of organizational management, and that this philosophy of cooperation, you know, it might be a useful one to consider in terms of how you manage an enterprise. And the book, it talks about, you know, yes, it talks about the importance of cooperation. But at the same time, you know, we tend to focus too much on this capitalistic framework. And there are other frameworks or philosophies that can be considered along with capitalism. So Spalding, yes, he was a capitalist, but he did a lot of this whole philosophy of cooperation. So I just hope some of the listeners get that from this conversation we had today. And I hope you can explore it more in the book.
Just want to say thank you to Lyon and Simone for doing something which is very close to our hearts here on the podcast, that is helping us explore classic texts in management and organization studies and using them to try and make sense of what we see and experience in workplaces today. So thank you for that. And in particular, helping us dig into what we can learn from non-traditional sources of Management and Organizational Studies. So thank you for that.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And that concludes episode 56. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And please join us next month as we discuss another classic work from Management and Organizational Studies, here on Talking About Organizations.